Hello, everyone. Welcome to Peer to Peer Real Estate Show. I'm your host, William Morales. And on today's show, I have Neil Bawa. He's the CEO and founder of Grow Capitalist, a commercial and real estate investment company. Neil, thank you so much for being on Peer to Peer Real Estate again. How are you?
Thanks for having me on the show. I'm great. Thank you.
So, Neil, tell us what you've been up to since the last time we talked, which is probably maybe 6-7 months ago, give or take.
We've been extremely busy. And the reason for that is, we are eating our dog food. About 2 years ago, you know, one of the most common questions I get is, which is the best asset class for long-term wealth creation? And I'm going to underline that word again, long-term wealth creation. And I've always said that single family is good, multifamily is good, but long-term wealth creation is best done through fourplexes. And I've said that for a number of years, and people have said, why is the fourplex class so special? Well, you get the scalability of multifamily, but you get these awesome, you know, 30-year fixed loans, basically, with, you know, lower costs. You can house hack, so you can get, you know, loans with 3% down. So there's so many benefits that fourplexes have that I don't have with large multifamily. And so people would come back to me and say, you've been saying this for years, but you don't actually sell any fourplexes. You don't actually do anything with fourplexes. And like, yeah, we, you know, we're scaled up and it's really hard to do something with fourplexes. And so after years of taking that criticism, eventually he came back and said, it seems that people really like this messaging that we talk about. And all these years, we've never done fourplexes. So eventually we came up with a plan and implemented it. And as we were implementing it, COVID struck. So we thought, okay, we don't know whether this is going to go well or not, but it went phenomenally well. And so we have now done 3 fourplex communities, and all of them during COVID, by the way. Every one of them, every dime that was raised was COVID. Every property that was sold, you know, so that these are fourplexes, they're also sold to the end investor. Right. Everything was done through COVID. And I have to say that not in my wildest dreams had I thought that there would be so much hunger and so much demand for the end product of these syndications, which is the fourplex. It has been absolutely astonishing. So the last 9 months have been the best 9 months professionally that I've ever had. So it's been phenomenal.
That's amazing. And we'll definitely touch base on the syndication part of your business. So what was the reason going back a few years ago that you got into real estate? What was it that you saw of that asset class that made you want to get in?
Well, you know, I had the big fat technology salary and I live in California. So I was basically I was paying 50% in taxes. So the depreciation from real estate is what really got me into it. The CEO of my technology company, I was a junior partner, he was a senior partner, basically got me into real estate by asking me for help in building a technology campus from scratch. So most people, you know, start by doing single family. I started by building a $6 million campus from scratch under his, you know, guidance. And that got me into real estate. And then, of course, like everybody else, I went through the single family route. I bought 13 single family homes. I managed them. I still own 10 of those and slowly built my way up to multifamily over time. So first, you know, real estate transaction was 2003, that $6 million campus. First single family was 2008. And then first large multifamily was 2014.
Right. So I wanted to touch base on that. You know, when you go to these markets, you know, and you're buying, you invest in 9 different states. So when you go into these markets that you've never been before, what is the data that you look for? Like what's your criteria to getting into these nice states, especially, you know, when you're, you know, away from California?
So that's really what I'm best known for. I'm a data scientist, and you know, the reason that most people know me is because I have a system that I invented called the Real Focus System. It's now kind of pretty well developed, and about 50,000 people a year use this system on an active basis. They come to our website and they download the system itself. It's free. Mm-hmm. And the system's composed of 5 parameters at a city level and 5 at a neighborhood level. And the city parameters are a certain amount of population growth in that city, a certain amount of job growth, a certain amount of home price growth, a certain decline in crime, and a certain increase in incomes, right?
Okay.
Notice that with all 5 of these, I use the word certain, because what I find is people say, well, go to a city that has growing population. that actually is a nonsensical statement. It doesn't really mean anything because the U.S. is a growing country. Most places, even some of the more really horrible places to invest in, have some population growth. And most places have some income growth because of this thing called inflation, right?
Right.
Practically anything that you're investing in, even like horrible markets in Louisiana are going to have some income growth because of inflation. But you need a certain amount of income growth beyond inflation because the first 1.5% of income is really going towards inflation. It's the part beyond that that is growing your ability to buy expensive goods like real estate and cars, yeah. Right? So that's what we need. And so the real focus system defines a certain amount of growth in all of these areas and a reduction in crime. And it says you need this much amount of those. And then it tells you where to go find that information for your favorite city. So the system works for 3,300 cities in the U.S.,
okay.
All the way from superstar cities like Los Angeles, all the way down to my favorite city in America, which is 106,000 people. It's called Idaho Falls. It's in Idaho.
Okay.
So it goes all the way from 10 million people to 100,000 people and anything in between. And to us, that is what has made us successful. We are about to exit in COVID times with a project that will make 55% annualized for our investors.
Wow.
And really the big reason is it's in a city that you've never heard of, Dalton, Georgia, the carpet capital of America, 33,000 people nestled in the hills 40 miles from Chattanooga.
Wow.
Who cares about these places, right?
Right, right.
But the numbers said this is a very, very good place to invest in. It's got an enormous supply-demand gap. It's got all of these population, the numbers that I just gave you, all of them were through the roof. So we invest in these weird kinds of places like Idaho Falls, St. George, Utah, Dalton, Georgia, from North Carolina. None of these are superstar cities. None of these are cities that you hear about often on William's podcast. And that's right. What we are known for the use of data, you know, because my background is data science. So we take that data science and we apply it to real estate.
Wow, that's amazing. You know, and I like the fact that you go to these small towns, small cities, like you said, that no one ever heard of, and most people will say, oh, no, I want to, like you said before, I want to go into Orlando, I want to go into Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, but it's those little small, out-of-the-way type of cities and neighborhoods that you definitely see a trend, and you like you said, you see the market going in a certain direction. So when you go to these cities, I guess the biggest thing is, let's say for me, I'm in New York, but if somebody are in Los Angeles or Chicago, Boston, where the prices look like phone numbers, how do you build those teams in those areas? Do you personally go to these cities yourself? Or, with COVID now it's harder, but before then, how did you build these your teams there?
So, I mean, the visits are unavoidable, but I think that what most people do a really poor job of, whether they're going to a major city or a minor city, they do a very good poor job of preparing for a visit. Mm-hmm. So when we pick a city like Idaho Falls, so here's the process, and I think this process works regardless of the size of the city. So we picked Idaho Falls last year because we'd been following it for 4 or 5 years. It was climbing our charts on the small city. And it's not that we only invest in small cities. We'll invest in mid-sized cities as well. We just don't do very large cities like Dallas or Los Angeles or San Francisco.
Right.
We'll do mid-sized cities like San Antonio, right? Mm-hmm. So we'll do those kinds of cities because some of our investors just are not, you know, comfortable with these cities that they've never heard of, right? So that those people go for our mid-sized cities. So when I'm looking to open a new metro, the first thing that I do is that I do a lot of web searches, and I'm looking for a certain group of people, right? So I'm looking for brokers. And we do both development, and one of the things is we're not a standard syndication company which only buys value add. We do both. Half of our portfolio is value add. The other half is a new construction. Okay. So what I do is I'm looking for brokers. I'm looking for bankers. I'm looking for engineers, and these are civil engineers, and I'm looking to visit the city officials. So when I went to Idaho Falls, we spent a huge amount of time figuring out the people in that city that matter, the influencers. So we went and saw Brad and Dana at the city. They introduced us to Rebecca Meyer, who's the mayor of Idaho Falls. We got connected with them. we got connected with the main influencers. Idaho National Labs is a massive, employer. So we went and talked with them. And then, of course, we went and talked with the brokers and the bankers, and they gave us lots of referrals. So our early phone calls, so we usually will make about 30 phone conversations, and then we use that to create a checklist of influencers, people that basically can give us projects. Because the one flaw with small markets, and it's a major flaw, it's a huge flaw, is that there is very little deal flow, right? So when you're trying to go in there and buy multiple properties, it's very, very difficult. Most of these properties never come to market. It's not like a large market where they list them. In small markets, you know, properties just exchange through, you know, connections. And so building those connections is, I would say, about 3 to 5 times the time that it takes to do a major market. Because in major markets, you're just calling all the brokers, right? And that's 80, 90%. I hear people say things like off-market this and off-market that. I have to really say this. This off-market stuff has completely gotten out of control. It's, you know, for the most part, bullshit. Because what they mean by off-market is there's a broker who's showing it to all of their best clients, but not really, you know, email blasting his entire database. Right? But his best clients are the ones that are buying today. So he's basically showing it to most of his database, most of the active database. So I think there's some shady stuff going on. The fact is 90% of syndication buyers today that are buying multifamily are buying listed properties, right? That I don't have to do in these small markets, these ultra small markets, and that's really the advantage. The key, though, is it takes 3 to 5 times to create a network. So that when there's a seller looking to go to market, he's going to be contacting you directly.
No, I love that. It's all about the relationship. So I wanted to talk about your first deal, your first multifamily property. How did you acquire it? How did you find it? And how did you fund it? So that's basically three questions in one. What was your first multifamily deal? How did you find it? And how did you fund it?
It was in Chicago. It was a 237 unit in Jackson Park. Now, of course, that area is well known because the Obama Presidential Library is being built 100 yards from where our property is. And we found that one. That one was a listed property. So we found it, we weren't at that point, you know, seasoned enough to have off-market capability. So we found it, in a listed fashion. How did we fund it? Oh, my God. We thought we didn't know what we were doing. I mean, we had no idea. And so we basically signed up on this, you know, on this property. We went hard on 100K. Now, the buyer gave us a lot of time. So it actually took us 5.5 months to fund 3.5 million people. It now takes us about 12 hours, right, to fund, you know, $5 to $10 million. And we funded about $70 million, you know, for our projects. So, but back then it was very, very, very difficult. So it was just like anybody and everybody that we could find to talk to about this property. And just constantly holding webinars, seminars, holding events with, you know, 3 people attending. Now, I mean, when I do a webinar, there's 600 people attending these webinars. But back then, 3 was a good turnout, right? So whatever you had to do.
Yeah, no, that's how you listen. That's how you get the word out. So when did you start Grow Capitalist? Like, what was the impetus for you to start that part of your company?
So my story is as follows. You know, once my founder kind of got me into real estate with that campus, I started investigating data-driven, metrics, analytics-driven, you know, data science-driven real estate, and I couldn't find anything at all in the marketplace, right? There were some people selling software for $30,000 a year, but they weren't telling people what was in there. It was just like, this is William's secret sauce, and you should buy it for $30,000, and it'll take you to the right places. And I was very annoyed about that because I came from, you know, high technology where, you know, Wikipedia is really truly free, right? For the most part, Google is truly free. So when I looked at that, I said, this stuff has to be given away for free. So I started researching, and it became my passion to create a system that would take, you know, direct people to the right places. I wanted to be completely free. It had to have no subscription, no upgrades. You know, so that became a passion for me. And I did that while I was still running my technology company. And to get the message for this system that I delivered out there, I became a meetup group organizer. In 2011, I opened my meetup group in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I started teaching the system. And I remember the first couple of times I taught it, there were like 6 or 7 people. And I was like, this is going to take forever, because my goal was to have 100,000 people, you know, use the system.
Right.
But it actually grew exponentially. Before I knew it, like 6 months later, there were 100 people attending these events because they liked what I had to say and the fact that I had nothing to sell. I wasn't a technologist. I didn't have anything to sell. I was a technologist. I wasn't a real estate guy. I didn't have anything to sell. So they really liked the fact that this guy's just giving this stuff away and he's so passionate about it and they love talking with me. So my database started to grow, and eventually some guy came in that was like a syndicator, and he came in and said, you know, you're really creating an audience here. What are you doing with it? And I said, nothing. I'm a technologist. You know, I mean, I have a day job. He's like, no, listen, this is really something. It's a skill that you have. It's an ability. You should be using this database. Start collecting these people. So I went out and bought an iPad with a keyboard and started basically gathering people's information, started building a database. And so 2013, July, my company was sold. I was a partner in the company, so I sold it. I invested the money in a bunch of passive syndications, but I still had money left over myself.
Right.
And so that's when I really started to jump into this business. Now, I did it under another company. I wasn't confident enough to do it with myself, so I became a junior partner in someone else's company. And did that for a while. And then in 2018, I said, you know what? I've done 7 syndications. I kind of know what I'm doing now. It's time for me to separate. So then I separated and opened my own company. By that time, I was really well known. I had a huge number of investors. They followed me in on. And so that company very, very quickly started doing syndications. So we've now done 17 syndications in that company. And we've raised about $65 million for syndications. We have 3 divisions.
Right.
One does value-add multifamily and student housing.
Okay.
One does new construction, multifamily and student housing. And then the third division only does 4-plexes. So that division is the newest. It's about a little over a year and a half old. And it only sells 4-plexes to investors, new construction 4-plexes, brand new 4-plexes.
Right.
And so those 3 divisions are what is Grow Capitalist is comprised of.
Do you need if somebody wanted to invest with your company Grow Capitalist, do they need to be an accredited investor, or are you working towards letting other investors eventually get in? How would you structure that if that's possible?
The truth is this. I mean, and this is advice for all of you listening out there that are budding syndicators. There is too much unnecessary focus put on non-accredited investors.
Okay.
I have done statistical analysis, and in all of the deals where I allowed non-accredited investors, the total dollar volume of those non-accredited investors was never more than 13% of the total money that I raised.
Okay.
So at one point, I said, this is the end of it. I'm never going to do this again. I'm going to only work with accredited investors. I am not out there for charity. This is a business. Accredited investors, once you target only those investors, once you focus only on those investors, the ability to raise money, that your velocity is much higher. So it's been a long time since we've had a non-accredited deals. I can tell you very straightforward, we will never have a future deal with non-accredited investors. So accredited only. Now, non-accredited do buy 4-plexes from us because they're not investing, they're buying.
Right.
And they have the right to buy those. And you'd be surprised how many non-accredited investors have the ability to put $250,000 down to buy a $1 million quadplex. But they don't have the ability to, you know, to be accredited because a lot of their assets are so distributed that they don't have a way of proving that they're worth $1 million.
I see. Okay. No, that's good to know because, as you know, Neil, we got all these companies now that take non-accredited investors with little as $500 down for an investment. And, you know, are you setting up these guys for failure, especially, like you said, that, you know, they don't have the ability, in my opinion, to learn the numbers and see how the system works. What do you think about these type of companies that are looking, you know, for these type of people that are not accredited, and they'll take their $500, $1,000?
Regardless of whether it's Patch of Land or it's one of these others that are doing this,
yeah,
I would study these companies to see if they've actually made any money.
Mm.
When you are taking a non-accredited investor, and every time you take a non-accredited investor, there's a lot of compliance risk that you're taking.
Yeah.
You're taking, like, you know, 100 of them at $500 each just to get to $500,000. These are basically dot-com companies. They're not real estate companies. They are dot-com companies that are funded with venture capital money, as you know, venture capital has about a 91% failure rate, right, with a 9% success rate. I'm yet to see one of these companies, a patch of land is a good example, that have actually made money. What they're trying to do is they're trying to spend a lot of money acquiring investors who are investing $500. I mean, their acquisition cost is probably more than $500.
Right.
And they're not making, when an investor invests $500, patch of land might make $50. The rest of it really goes to the syndicator and goes to the investor. So they're not making that much money. From what I can see, these are trial and error business models, and who knows, the next Amazon might come out of it. But from the moment, it appears to make no rational sense to allow a non-accredited investor to invest $500, because your cost of acquisition of that investor is probably $500 to $1,000. Ours is over $1,000 an investor. So we couldn't possibly make money if we allowed them to invest $500. We allow a $100,000 minimum, and I would never bring that number down because it wouldn't make sense.
Right. No, good point. Because like some of the people that I talk to, they always want to go to Patch of Land or Fundrise and all these companies. I always say, just like you got to do due diligence. You got to see these companies are making money, which is a great point that you made. So I want to go back to your syndication business. When you started syndicating, when was your first foray into it? Was this a few years ago? Do you remember?
2014. So okay. We did our first syndication. It was a very small syndication before we did the 237 unit in Chicago that I told you about. That was, I'd say it was either late 2013 or early 2014. Mm-hmm. And I kind of sort of learned the process of syndication in that project. It was very small. It was 12 units.
That's okay. It was a start. So you've been doing it now. It's going on 7 years. What are the ups and downs of the syndication business, if there is any? Like, can you tell us a little bit of the pluses and minuses, especially that's doing the syndicating as yourself?
Sure. I think the big plus is this. I find that most investors do not have the time to do as good of a job with their properties as they think. So I will issue a challenge to everyone who's listening, right? If there are 100 single family investors, especially ones that have more than one property, I would say one or two of them actually does a profit and loss statement every month. Most investors go out there, they do the math, they buy the property, and then they're like, I'm just going to live with it. You know, I've already bought it, so what, right? But that's not what you signed up to do. You signed up to be an investor. Right. An investor, by definition, measures their success or lack thereof every month. How much money did I make? Did I actually make what I put on my pro forma? Right? Most of them are like, yeah, maybe I made 2% less. No, that's not you being an investor. That's you being a speculator. I rolled the dice, and now the dice is rolled. That's not an investor, right? So most people who are single-family investors don't actually put in the time and effort to do a good job. And I find that most syndicators – except maybe, you know, people that are first-time starters, most syndicators are putting much more time on your behalf. They're putting much more effort on your behalf, and your outcome is likely to be higher. Most syndicators that have done more than three projects are full-timers. So you've got that advantage. You know, they're looking at your property on a full-time basis. So I think that's the pro. The con is this. The average syndicator was buying Class C value-add properties, multifamily, for about $60,000 a door about 5 years ago.
Right.
That syndicator is now paying $100,000 a door. But inflation in those 5 years has only been 2%. Therefore, in 5 years, compounded inflation is about 12%. So that the $60,000 should have gone up to about 67 or 68.
Right.
Well, it's gone up to 100, right? So what does that mean? That profits have to be shrinking. You know, rents have only gone up maybe 15%, so prices should have gone up 15, maybe 20%. Well, they've gone up 60%, 50, 60%, right? More than 50%, 60%. So the truth is that in 2021, the profits for syndication have been shrinking, making syndication riskier each year that has gone by. And that has not changed with COVID. Syndicators have gotten a little bit of room, a little bit of breathing room, because interest rates have come down where they were expected to go up. So that's a positive, you know, thing that has happened in syndication. But in general, the pie is shrinking, and the number of syndicators increased. There's three times more syndicators in the market today than 6 years ago, right? But the pie has shrunk a lot because all these $50,000, $60,000 low-hanging per door fruit are gone. Doesn't matter where in the U.S. they are, they're gone. So I think it's and obviously this happens to everything else. It's happening to the stock market as well. But there's definitely a lot more profit today in 2021 than there was 5 years ago.
Right, that's amazing. So for you, you know, you're in the multifamily business. Would you ever even consider the office space, or is that too risky, especially now with COVID, where we're seeing, you know, predictions where maybe 20% of a workforce from a, you know, company A might be working from home. Now, you know, there's that much space left in the office. What do you think about the office market? I know it's not your forte, but is that something that you might look for in the future?
I've had office experience because when I build mixed-use properties, there's usually office on the bottom floor. So I've had some office experience. Maybe 2% of my portfolio is office. And here are my thoughts on this. COVID was a stress test for the commercial real estate and multifamily market. It was an incredible stress test. And when you look at what has really come well through the stress test, there are three asset classes that showed weaknesses. Retail.
Yeah.
Hotel and office. Now, having said that, I must clarify that of these three, the one that has suffered the least is office by far.
Right.
Why? Because a lot of office tenants had long-term leases and they are continuing to honor those leases because they are businesses with lots of money. So we've seen very little actual stress in the office market, even lesser than multifamily. But, and this is a big but, we are projecting that as those leases come up for renewal, at least 20% of them will not renew or renew a much smaller space. So we think that over the next 3 to 4 years, there's going to be an incredible amount of growing stress in the office market. Retail, of course, has been completely decimated. You know, they're having an incredibly bad time. Hotels, I feel bad for them because I don't think hotels were overvalued. I think they were properly valued as of March 1st of this last year. And then, you know, this thing just completely, you know, a bulldozer was run over them. So at this point, you know, average hotel occupancy in the U.S. is about 50%. They need about an average of 60 to break even. So they're bleeding money like crazy. You're going to see a lot of defaults in the hotels in the next 6 months. So to me, those three asset classes showed their weakness. I've never invested in any of those three. I have, as I said, a very small amount of office in my mixed-use multifamily projects. So if anything, it tells investors that you really have to understand where different asset classes are because of where things are. I think it's also proven that multifamily is not the best asset class. In my mind, the best asset class for the next 10 years, at least for the next 3 years, is industrial. It's so massively outperformed in the last 9 months because of one simple statement. The moment I say this, everybody will be like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. So we had 6 years of e-commerce growth in the first six COVID months, right? And e-commerce doesn't need multifamily. E-commerce doesn't need office space. It doesn't need hotels. But what it does need is warehousing. It needs logistics. It needs areas where trucks can be driven in directly. It needs roll-up doors. Those are the things that e-commerce needs,
right?
And so what we are seeing is that, you know, e-commerce spiked like crazy, and now it's kind of plateaued, but it's plateaued at a completely different levels. And we need over 1 billion square feet of industrial space for this new level, right? Even if it plateaus, I think it's going to start going up again in the future. But even at a plateau, we obviously in the last 6 months, we didn't build 1 billion square feet of industrial. So to me, I think that is the best asset class. Storage did pretty well. We have a storage portfolio and self-storage has done fairly well.
Right.
And of course, multifamily has done well, right? But, you know, we've got obviously, you know, slowly declining rents in the U.S. We've seen a 1% rent decline in the U.S. We've also seen an increase in delinquency. But despite those two things, multifamily seen incredible strength. If anything, cap rates in multifamily have not gone up. You know, they've slightly compressed because of interest rates going down. So I think these three asset classes, industrial, self-storage, multifamily, have separated them from the other asset classes in the pack.
Yeah, no, I you know, it's funny that you talk about retail, because here in New York City, Neil, whenever I pass by a small retail stores, and now we're seeing some of these big stores closing down, you know, Macy's closing some stores, I think Lord and Taylor's going to close. It's amazing. And you hate it because it's people are losing jobs. But are we afraid? Is there a part that we might be overbuilding in some of these cities, especially, you know, maybe in San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, of multifamily, these huge commercial real estate deals? Is it possible that we could be overbuilding and not have enough tenants for these type of new construction?
You know, it's a complex question and has a complex answer. So one of the things is I get this question a lot because people know that I do a lot of analytics. So each year I put together the answer to your question into a presentation. I call it Real Estate Trends. Mm-hmm. And this presentation is then presented to tens of thousands of people across a number of different platforms. You can check it out at multifamilyu.com. And this is being recorded on the 18th of Jan. We'll be announcing it next week, and the presentation will actually be delivered at the end of January.
Okay.
And in there, in that presentation, you'll notice that I am providing this answer for every asset class. I'll provide an answer for retail, an answer for office, an answer for student housing, an answer for senior housing. I think that the answer is that it's a complex answer. So sometimes you have asset classes that have too much new construction, like self-storage has had too much new construction in what is known as gateway markets. A lot of the bigger right. markets, self-storage has too much construction, and so we're seeing declining rents there.
Right.
But then you have these medium-sized markets where self-storage is doing really well. Retail, I think, is very heavily overbuilt in the really large markets, and also the very fast-growing markets. So Phoenix, Dallas, Nashville, these being fast-growing markets, we've seen retail getting overbuilt. So the truth is this. People make, you know, judgmental statements. They make broad statements, and they don't tell you that, okay, this statement's not across the board. Because the truth is there are currently markets in the U.S. where retail, rents are actually going up. And you might say, really? There is such a market? The answer is yes. There's markets that are underbuilt. And so prices are going up, even though they're probably going up 1% a year, not like multifamily where some markets have gone up 4%, 5%, 6% this year. Like Phoenix has gone up about, 6% in during COVID, which is phenomenal, right? So I think the answer is it's all about where in the U.S. you are. Today I can tell you Orlando was a market that I was touting in January, and I was completely wrong because I didn't know that COVID would hit. Obviously, because that market is so reliant on international tourism, people coming in from Europe and from South America. It's in a perfect location for both South American and European tourism. That market is really hurting. Whereas Reno, on the other hand, which was also a gambling town, is not hurting much because Reno had industrial because of Tesla moving there. And also Reno was very close to California. So a lot of people decided we can't travel to Asia anymore. We can travel to Europe. We're going to go to Tahoe. And of course, when you go to Tahoe, you go to Reno, right?
Right, of course. Right.
So that area was hit a lot less. So COVID has created this odd recession where some places are going through recession, some are not. The states of Utah and Idaho have felt no recession whatsoever, right? And both states have lost only about 1% of their jobs from when, from pre-COVID. So these are states where it's like, what COVID? What's COVID? Right? It's amazing to be there and experience the incredible growth that Idaho and Utah are seeing.
Oh, my God. You know, it's so important, like you just said, Neil, is the data, is you got to do your research. So talk more about your opportunity zones you are considering. Because I saw in your bio, opportunity zones are a big plus for you guys. Can you talk about more about that?
Yeah, I think I call them frustration zones, not opportunity zones, because I've done two projects in opportunity zones, and I've tried to do about 10, because the truth is this. I mean, there's an incredible amount of demand from investors for opportunity zone projects. I think that if we had taken those two projects and replicated them 5 times each, we would have sold them out. The problem with opportunity zones is that they are, by their very nature, a catch-22. Why would the government give you 10 years or more of completely free taxes? Remember, this is not tax deferral. This is tax gain.
Right,
you're just not paying taxes. Why would they do that unless the area was distressed? So the truth is, over 80% of opportunity zones in the United States, and there's 8,751 tracts, opportunity zone tracts, they're distressed. They're distressed. No one should be investing into opportunity zones in distressed areas, especially not new construction. As you know, new construction requires the upscale tenant. How do you match upscale tenant with lots of new construction in an opportunity zone where the area itself is depressed and most tenants basically are just barely making do? Where are they going to come up with the money for these Class A apartments that are being built? So the truth is that I have found it extremely difficult to call opportunity zones an opportunity. Now, there are exceptions because each state's governor was given a certain number of zones that they could just pick randomly regardless of whether that zone was depressed or not.
Right.
And I've only invested in those, right? And certain states were much cleverer about those than other states. Like Provo, Utah has an opportunity zone right in the middle of the city, which is phenomenal because I mean, there's nothing wrong with Provo, Utah. It's consistently been one of the fastest growing cities in America for the last 6 or 7 years.
Right.
And so they were very clever to have picked the zone right in the middle, and it was a big zone, and they just knocked it out of the park, right? So very few cities and states were that clever. So for the most part, I struggle with opportunity zones. I tell people this. If you're an investor and you're looking to invest in an opportunity zone, please follow this mantra, Neil's mantra. And the mantra is, when investing in an opportunity zone, first, worry about your principal. Then think about tax benefits. Your principal is at risk. Who cares about, you know, the interest or the tax on the profits if your principal is gone?
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So that's what I insist on. Make sure you're not investing into a ghetto.
No, you make a great point because if you go into an area where you said people are just barely making it, you know, they got a job that might pay them $30,000-$40,000, but now, you know, the next high rise there where the rent is $3,000 a month, you know, where are you going to find these tenants unless you're going to basically get rid of all the hate to say it, but the poor people that are in that area. And, you know, you're going to have a fight
that's,
back.
That's what's happening. Yeah, most opportunity zones are pushing out the poor people, but it takes a long time to do that.
Yeah.
Your project cannot wait 5 years for all the poor people to get pushed out. You're going to go bankrupt over those 5 years, right? So it's something that you have to be very careful. And I think that the risk-reward there is a little bit out of whack.
Right. No, good point. So tell us more about your multifamily U. How did you start it? How did you see the need for something like this?
So one of the things I noticed was that the industry had lots of great podcasts. So the podcasting arena was filled with lots and lots of talent. Mm-hmm. The industry had lots of great programs, whether they were education programs, those sorts of things. But what I didn't find is I didn't find a platform for data-driven, you know, webinars that were kind of long form, right? So 45 minutes to 2 hours duration long form webinars. No one was serving that need. So I said, instead of me becoming the millionth podcaster in the real estate market, I'm just going to go out and build a content portal because I'm very passionate about data. So I built Multifamily U, which is multifamily followed by the letter U.com, as a content portal. And I started inviting very experienced people, whether they were lawyers or, you know, tax CPAs or syndicators or, you know, just superstar experts like Bruce Norris, who, you know, he's known in California as a superstar. These people come in, and 20 times a year, we do webinars. And these webinars are very data-driven. They're not shallow. They're very in-depth webinars. I do 6 of them myself, and then there's about 14 that where we invite other people to do the webinars. We also do town halls. And we get consistently about 1,500 people registering for each webinar. We get about 600-700 that watch it live, and then about 300 that watch it using our YouTube channel. So we get all in all about 20,000 people watching these webinars. And there's no pitch, there's no sale, we never sell anything in a webinar. We mention our products for about 30 seconds and move on beyond that. And that, I think, is to me the best community builder that you can imagine. It's a niche that we are unique. We are the only webinar-style real estate portal in multifamily. And we continue to be that way because it takes an enormous amount of time and effort to build and maintain such a portal and to keep it free.
We're talking with Neil Bauer. If anybody goes to your website, to multifamilyu.com, can they look at the webinars from the past? Can they catch up to past webinars?
Absolutely. Not only can they look at not all of the webinars, but the most of them, the ones that these other presenters allow us to host.
Sure.
But they can also look at over 100 podcasts that we've done on various topics. You know, we are known for our virtual assistant expertise. I'm the only syndicator in America to have 20 full-time virtual assistants, all based in the Philippines, working for us. They report to our U.S. staff. So for every U.S. employee, we have two people in the Philippines. So we teach how to build those virtual assistant teams, how to recruit them, how to manage them. We also, you know, have a number of products, pre-project products that show you how to raise money. So all of that is on multifamilyu.com. So come in, take a look at those. We do teach a paid boot camp. We don't teach it very often because we've been busy with our syndication products. That's primarily where we make our money. And so four times a year, we teach a data-driven boot camp. It's about a tenth of the cost of typical boot camps in the U.S. I've been very annoyed at just how much these boot camps cost.
Oh, my God, yes.
They're not value for money, in my opinion. So I teach one that is under $3,000, and it's filled with our techniques. So there's about 10 hours of live demos of our portfolio as opposed to teaching hypotheticals. So we use our portfolio as a engine and we show it throughout the boot camp. And I think that's unique. As far as I know, no one else has ever showed off their portfolio live during a boot camp.
No, I know. I haven't seen it. So, and that's great because, again, people will see that you guys are actually doing what you say you're doing. You're not just talking about it. And talk about more about your meetup group. How did you form that? And if somebody wanted to join your meetup group, what would be a criteria?
So at this point, the meetup group obviously is virtual, and we're not doing a lot of it. We're basically connecting people through MultifamilyU. The meetup market is definitely saturated. At this point, what we're seeing is, you know, all the meetups have gone virtual, but still people are struggling to have more than 20 or 30 people in meetups. I think that the real power of meetups was the physical connection.
Networking,
being able
yes.
to stand in front of people and networking, shake hands. I love that aspect of it, and I don't think we get it back until maybe June or July of this year when enough people be vaccinated. I think that's where the power of meetup is. So we have a nationwide meetup network, but most of it is virtual. We were very, very active in California, and we intend to return to that post-COVID. For the moment, we're doing webinars like everybody else, and our webinars are very scaled with 500 or 600 people attending.
Yeah, I know. I agree. I mean, I'm not a fan of being in a networking event that you have to do virtual. I'm like you. I like to meet people, talk to people, get the gauge of what they want to do. I mean, listen, first of all, Neil, thank you so much for being on P2P Real Estate. I really appreciate it. And before I let you go, just a couple more things. Any books you would like to recommend? What is Neil reading at the moment? Or do you have your own book?
Well, I think that to me, the greatest book of all is The Miracle Morning because it allows you to read other books.
I have that book, Neil.
It gives you the gift of time to read others.
I have that book, Neil, and I have to definitely. I have to read it. Yes. So thank you for sharing that.
I mean, I wouldn't say it's the best book in the world.
Right.
I would say it's the most important book in the world because we all struggle to find time to read books. The Miracle Morning gives you the time to read other books, which you might like more. Which might change your life more. So, you know, books like that, you know, and for business scale, that scaled like me, Traction is a phenomenal book. It's not for people looking to create a business. It's for people looking to grow a business, to scale a business. I think it's an incredible book. But if you're just starting the business, I would recommend The One Thing. The One Thing is a phenomenal book
yes.
about the power of focus. And I think it's an absolutely incredible product.
Yeah, no, Jay, that's a great book. The One Thing, I definitely recommend that. And if anybody wanted to get in contact with you, what's the best way?
Well, I'm really easy to get in touch with. I happen to be the only Neil Bauer on the World Wide Web. So if you type in N-E-A-L-B-A-W-A into Google, hit enter. The first couple hundred articles are either me presenting at a conference or me in a podcast or presenting on someone else's platform. So you'll see lots and lots of links. You know, to connect with me, it's just neal@multifamilyu.com. You can send me an email. It will not go to me. It'll go to an assistant, but they will answer appropriately and move emails over to me. Multifamilyu.com is probably the other way to get in touch with it. We have a massive Facebook group. We have 12,000 people in it. It's called Magic of Multifamily. So if you're into Facebook type interaction, check out Magic of Multifamily. We also have a YouTube channel with about 3,000 subscribers called Multifamily U. I'm actually personally most active on YouTube. So we release at least 2 YouTube videos a week. Some weeks we have 3. Actually, last week was big. We had 4 videos that we released. So we get over 10,000 minutes of our videos watched every week.
No, that's good. Well, listen, Neal, thank you so much again for being on P2P Real Estate Show. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Having me, William.
Yep, bye-bye. Well, everyone, that was Neal Bauer, and you can find him at multifamilyu.com. That's multifamilyu.com. Neal, thank you so much for being on Peer to Peer Real Estate Show. Really appreciate it. You can find me at peertopeerrealestate.com. That's peer, the number 2, peerrealestate.com. Check out our blog. Check out our past shows. Also, when you get a chance, please go to Apple Podcasts. Please subscribe and review. Tell us how we can make this show better. And before I go, guys, just a couple of more things. Do not give up on your dreams. Fight for it, guard it, protect it. Don't let anyone talk you out of it. And I really believe if you keep the momentum going, good things will happen. On behalf of Peer-to-Peer Real Estate, I'm William Morales. Until next time, thanks, everybody. Have a great day, and please stay safe. Bye.